Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web. I'm Andy Cersini.
And I'm Chris Bernard.
And our two other co-hosts, Devinder Hardawar and Dwayne DeFreitas, are currently out. Devinder's got a work thing, and Dwayne has too. So for now, it's just you and I. And on tonight's show, we're going to talk about Facebook going public, Google officially making things, Microsoft going social, Mark Zuckerberg getting hitched, and private enterprise launching into space. But first, every week, we like to do a little thing we called What We're Playing With, where we talk about some of the cool gadgets and apps that we've experienced during the week. And let's talk about that first one now. So this week, I've been playing with Google launched a Google Doodle, which is really interesting because it's probably the most interactive doodle that they've ever launched, and it is in celebration of Robert Moog's 78th birthday. Robert Moog is created an electronic synthesizer that was named after him, the Moog synthesizer. And so Google created an actual playable Moog synthesizer, and it's really elaborate and amazing. It lets you twist the knobs and actually record your doodlings on it. Have you seen this? Did you play around with this?
Yeah, I have to admit I was a little bit late to start my work this morning because I was attempting to recreate some melodies on it and playing around. It's amazing the level of just funky sounds and whatnot that you can get with it.
I'm just amazed that they were able to squeeze all of that, all of the complexity of the Moog synthesizer into a playable app.
Yeah, and as far as I can tell, well, actually, I can tell it's done with basically JavaScript because I have Flash blocked by default on my computer, even on Google properties, and it played without any problem on mine. And they might have a Flash fallback if you're on like an older system, but it's pretty awesome that they that it just plays in a web browser, and yeah, I don't know. It was really fun. I agree. You sort of put it in the show notes like Google outdoes itself. I must say this is the only other one I can think of that was it wasn't quite as fun. But remember when they had the instant search that started off with a zipper, where you would start typing on the home page and it would unzip the page to reveal your search results?
Oh, I vaguely remember that, but I do remember a zipper that they not too long ago, like last week or a couple weeks ago, they did have a tribute to the guy who invented the zipper, and it was a pull-down zip thing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Went to the second page. I was impressed with that just because of – I still honestly have not figured out entirely how they did that. I mean,
don't you love it when they stump you by doing something that you have no idea how they do it, and it seems so effortless and easy.
I know, and like this is my field. I'm like, darn it, Google making me look bad.
Let me see if I can play a little bit on this Google Doodle now. Okay, I can't honestly take credit for that. That was somebody on the internet who actually had the deaf skill to be able to work the Google Doodle in a way to actually make music. I only made like noises when I played with it, so I'm very jealous.
Hey, I made some pretty cool noises when I played with it. It's pretty cool. I think it's a pretty worthy tribute. I think we really take for granted the level of electronics and electronic sounds and music these days. I mean, you know, the early electronic music, like the Doctor Who theme and some of the stuff off of like Pink Floyd. I mean, that stuff was literally like sound generators, and they would take tapes and like cut them into segments and then, like, tape them together. I mean, it was nothing even remotely high tech the way we think of high tech now.
Right.
It was hard, intensive, dreary labor to make every little sound. And now, you know, there's, you know, the classic example is the Gorillaz album that was made on an iPad. And actually, along those lines, my thing playing with this week, there's an iPhone app which is called Figure. And I don't remember how much it is. It's made by Propellerhead, and it's this really slick, basically soundtrack beat creator type app. Just fun. I mean, it doesn't really do anything special, but you can really make some pretty awesome rocking beats just playing around in your spare time with it. And yeah, it is one of my more favorite doodly apps to play around with while I'm, you know, waiting for the train or the bus or sitting around.
I am going to check that out because I love Reason, you know, which is Propellerhead's PC, full PC music synthesizer.
Mm-hmm.
That's like their flagship product, Reason, and that's great. And it says that Figure. I'm looking at the Propellerhead site right now, and it says that Figure is powered by Reason, so should be pretty cool.
Well, Reason looks really pretty overwhelming.
Oh, Reason's great. I mean, it's kind of a steep learning curve, but once you figure it out, it's really cool. Of course, this comes from someone who can't really play music but likes to noodle around. So, why don't we talk about some of our headlines this week? This week, Japanese web retailer Rakuten announced that it's leading a $100 million round in Pinterest. Which values the company at about $1.5 billion. Pinterest, which is relatively new, lets users create boards of images related to their interests. It's become a darling of e-commerce. The company sends big traffic to online retailers and also drives more revenue per click than Twitter or Facebook. Chris, what do you think about this? How does this place Pinterest in the sphere of social networks now? I mean, this to me seems like a huge deal for them.
Yeah, this is, I mean, this puts them straight up there with, well, let's see, how many billion dollar plus social networks do we have? We have Instagram, we have Facebook. Has Twitter been officially evaluated? I mean, I would assume Twitter's around a billion now, but I mean, I think it's been a while since they took on any funding, so
right.
we haven't got any clear numbers on that recently. But yeah, that's pretty unique up there for valuations. I mean, I don't know. Like, honestly, I think that I don't know exactly what their numbers are, and you know, they're still a private company, so it's kind of all guesswork as to why, you know, these investors are doing this. But I don't think that this is, you know, superfluous, bubbly investing at all. I mean, we know that Pinterest is wildly popular, and has an honest-to-goodness business model, which seems to work really well right now. They should take on more funding, keep growing. They definitely were struggling with their servers for a while, a few months ago when I first signed up. Like, you would go on their page and it would freeze every 30 seconds while it reloaded everything, and they seem to have really overcome that. But I must say, I find it a very compelling product. I've always sort of been a collector of pictures and sort of fun stuff on the internet. And I was using Tumblr to sort of share that stuff for a while, but it just seemed sort of anticlimactic to be like, here's this cool building that I found. And then, like, Tumblr doesn't really allow you to find it again. It doesn't allow you to bookmark it. It doesn't allow other people to do much except comment or reblog it. Particularly the sort of, like, Pinterest has this really cool concept of, like, both sharing things with other people but also sharing it with yourself, essentially. So, like, one of my friends who works at MIT's Media Lab, and she works with both theater and technology, you know, she has done some, you know, when she's doing basically research on how something should look for a play, either a costume or a prop or whatever, you know, and she did this all the way back in undergrad, you know, you go through and you find like just pictures that seem inspirational to you. They're like, well, you know, I like this picture and I like this thing and I like this thing. And yet it's important to know, like, you know, where did that come from? Like, do I need to credit it if I use it? Like, where can I find more stuff like that? And Pinterest, like, keeps all that. Like, if you click on the picture, it'll go to the original link page. And allows you to, you know, see it, but also allows you to sort of really get some awesome inspiration yourself. It's sort of like Dribbble. I don't know if you use Dribbble or have gone on Dribbble, but it's sort of like Dribbble for non-creative people. Like, Dribbble just makes me feel sad about my lack of drawing abilities. Pinterest is where I can just, like, take all the ideas that I want and just, like, keep them somewhere so that when I'm, you know, designing an interface or something, I can look back on what's sort of inspired me over the last few months or whatever.
I'm really surprised at Pinterest, because when Pinterest first launched, I think I mean, it had kind of this reputation as being a like a bookmarking site for women because of all the sharing of images of women's, like, women's clothing and other women's subjects, like dresses and shoes and stuff like that. And I think a lot of people, including myself, may have underestimated the power of Pinterest.
And, yeah, well, when you first hear about it, you're like, wait a minute, just a bunch of – I mean, it sounds like a blog platform without any of the things that normally make blogging significant, like comments and link backs and a URL where you can follow somebody, you know, just like pure – you know, pictures and everything. But, you know, it hits a certain level of that market. I mean, I don't know. It's hard to say. For all we know, it might end up being a gimmick. I mean, like, people sort of get excited about a certain way of doing something, and then suddenly it's not cool anymore. I remember, like, there was a while back where, like, there was that company that encouraged you to, like, take all your photos and, like, scrapbook them and everything. I can't remember what it was called, but my mom and my aunt were, like, super into it for a while.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not happening anymore.
Yeah. I think Pinterest is the ideal, is this hits that sweet spot of what that was trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
Let's move on here. So you were talking about how you like to collect sites like this. And Microsoft launched their own social network over this last week called Social. Well, it's pronounced Social, but it's spelled S-O-C-L in, once again, like, another example of Microsoft kind of making things a lot more complicated than it needs to be. It's not designed to be a Facebook challenger. It's designed to give students the ability to network with their peers to share information. Much like Facebook share or recommend buttons, Social has a bookmarklet feature that adds a share on social button to users' bookmark toolbars, allowing them to share interesting websites with other social users. In addition to sharing, commenting, and tagging other users' posts, they can also riff on the post, a feature Microsoft describes as a new way to interact and improvise with content. A standout feature of Social is the ability to create video parties that allow users to search for and assemble videos they can share with other users. Have you checked this out?
I've looked at it briefly. It sounds intriguing. I don't really understand what I'm supposed to do with it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that doesn't really bother me sort of looking at it, because it looks like – so it even says, like, on the branding, this is a Microsoft research project.
Mm-hmm.
And Microsoft, you know, has a very prolific research arm, which just sort of, like, comes up with something, throws it out there, and just sees, you know, what sticks and what people like, and then sort of wrap those into other products going forward, which honestly, like – Google could take a lesson out of this. I know it's amazing, Google learning a lesson from Microsoft. But, you know, this is the way to build a social network that could actually become significant. Don't attack Facebook head on. Don't attack Twitter head on. Like, they dominate their field so well that trying to make something that is a clone but better is just never going to work. You need to come up with something that's, like, sideways – that gets a ton of people by doing something orthogonal to what Facebook does. And then you can, you know, start to attack it by adding features more like Facebook. But, you know, when you're Burger King and you're attacking McDonald's, right. I mean, everyone knows Burger King is just second place McDonald's. That's what we think about it. It's the second place McDonald's. Whereas, like, Chipotle, yes, they're also smaller than McDonald's, but they're attacking the whole fast food arena in like just a totally other direction. So we don't even like connect them, and they're very successful because of that. And you know, usually we don't even see it as a trade. We consider them, you know, comparable, so that they actually end up being sort of more successful as a network, even though because they're doing something different. And I feel like I have no idea whether or not social is going to be, you know, good or not. And I don't even entirely understand what it is, but I have to applaud Microsoft for approaching the social world from this sort of like quiet, we're just going to roll it out there. We're going to see if anybody gets it. We're not going to like tout it. We're not going to say that everyone in our company's bonuses depends on this thing taking off. Like,
right. You know, like Google did with Eric Schmidt, his pronouncement.
Yeah, I feel like that's going to backfire. either it's going to backfire in like the sense that like they don't do well and everyone doesn't get their bonus and they're getting pissed off, or they're just going to be like, oh yeah, it's doing great. We had all these people sign up. None of them actually go on or use it, but hey, they're signed up, so therefore we win. You know, either it's going to be like, you know, either whitewash something which really isn't doing well, or make everyone feel bad because this thing, which was probably not going to work to begin with, didn't work. yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. It reminds me of something like a cross between a Google Plus and a Pinterest, because it's got these categories that you can throw your tags into, like Pinterest, and it's got this kind of flowing, constantly flowing stream like Google Plus. So, and once again, like you, I'm not entirely sure what it's for, but I welcome the competition. I welcome the maybe not competition, but additional voice in social there. And like you know, with any new social thing, I joined right away just to put my name in there, to put my account in there. So.
Yeah, I discovered actually when Pinterest got big that apparently I had signed up for it like in 2010 when it first when it first came out. You know what? Have you played around? This is not in the show notes. Mm-hmm. Have you played around with Social Cam at all?
No, I don't know what that is.
It's it's made by Justin TV. It's their second product. It's some sort of like social video application, but at least amongst my friends, it's gotten a huge amount of flack for just really, really, really kind of spammy, like ways of pushing itself. Like for a period of time, like that was all I would see on my Facebook feed. It's just social cam, social cam, social cam, social cam, and these like really like kind of spammy videos, like, you know, funniest looking people at Walmart.
Oh, interesting.
And then I got particularly annoyed because I had signed up for it on my Android phone when it previously came out, so I had an account with them, and I was going through my my Facebook feed sort of looking for some old posts I had done, and I found out they had claimed that I had watched Weirdest People Looking At. and I had saw this thing posted on my wall, like, you know, Chris Benoit watched a video, like, funniest looking people at Walmart. And I was like, I didn't watch that video. I didn't click on that. That's really bad. So if you're listening, JustinTV/SocialCam, stop doing that. That's annoying. I've blocked you because that's a spammy way to make your product go forward.
Let's move on here. Comcast, the largest cable and TV internet provider in the U.S., is changing its data cap policy on its broadband service to encourage customers to use its service without worrying about how much data they're consuming. However, they've announced that they're going to be testing a new pricing model for customers who use an excessive amount of data each month. In certain markets, the company will increase the cap which is now 250 gigs per month, to 300 gigs per month. And when customers exceed this cap, the company will charge an extra $10 for every 50 gigabytes of data that a user uses each month. Meanwhile, the company said it'll suspend the 250 gig cap in all other parts of the country while the test is underway. I see something like this, and I knew that this was going to happen. You know, way back when people started talking about data caps, it was obvious that it was going to go to a tiered service eventually,
yeah.
And then everyone is going to follow suit.
I mean, I guess to some extent, I don't know. I go both ways on this. I feel like to some extent, I understand, like, you know, bandwidth is not an unlimited resource. You know, we pay for bandwidth as, you know, Startup Digest. We have to pay for, you know, server time. We have to pay for bandwidth in and out of Amazon's center. I mean, it's a limited commodity and therefore should be priced to some level. But as a consumer, there's this sense in which, like, having to, you know, worry about how much, you know, you're using up in a month, especially when I guess the thing I found most annoying about the 250 gigabyte data cap is that it felt like a sort of punitive cap.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you went over it, it was like you're either going to get, you know, charged a ridiculous amount, or, you know, we're going to cut you off or give you a warning before we cut off or something, you know. But it's like, look, I'm paying for this service. You know, I don't mind paying more if I use it more, but it shouldn't be like a punishment if you're using too much. And then there's another even more important sense I have, which is like bandwidth doesn't work in the way that they're pricing it. I mean, what's really much more of a worry is peak pricing. I mean, if you know, your apartment complex has, say, a 1 terabyte, you know, per minute or second, whatever, you know, limit, and you have, you know, all 100 people in your, you know, apartment complex are watching, you know, the Olympics or something over their IPTV at the same time, like they might not be coming anywhere close to their 10 gigabytes per month limit, but they're going to use up that pipe extremely quickly. And you're still going to have, you know, degradation issues.
Right.
So like there's a sense in which, like, I know that like this is not going to actually attack the problem of, you know, how it's not going to attack the problem of limited bandwidth resources, because it's whether or not everyone's there all at the same time, not, you know, it's like basically if they charged you based on the total number of miles that you drove, you know, every day as a way of limiting traffic. I mean, the problem with traffic is not that people drive too far. The problem is that everyone is driving between 7 and 10 in the morning and then between 5 and 7 in the evening. And they may not be driving that far, but it clogs up the highways. I don't know. Personally, I think that they should do it by speed. I think that would be a far more effective way.
You mean
way.
If somebody goes over a certain amount, you lower their speed?
No, you it's tiered based on the speed that you want. If you want the cheap $60 a month one, it's capped at some, you know, nice but not overwhelming, you know, for the grandmas and people who like want to just like check their email and do sort of like basic stuff like that. And then for the superpower users who like really want, I mean, people are willing to pay for speed. That's something you can see and it feels good and everything. And then that would effectively allow them to limit their overall, you know, their bandwidth usage at any one time, because they would know like basically what the peak times are, and they would allow, you know, some people to basically effectively lowering their usage at any one particular time because they're not sending as many packets. I don't know. That's my not network administrator off the cuff solution to somebody else's problem, which probably is way more complex than that. But
all right, let's move on to our last headline of the evening, and one I think is like the most exciting to me. And that is that we now have officially a new era in commercial space transportation. SpaceX has made history by launching the Falcon Dragon ship, which is the very first commercial rocket launched into space. The mission is the first one organized by a private firm. It's going to the International Space Station, and it will deliver a grocery run of 1,000 pounds of food and clothing to astronauts there. It's a company founded by Elon Musk, who also founded Tesla. And also on board this is, oddly enough, also on board this rocket ship are the ashes of actor James Doohan, who played Scotty on the original Star Trek series. He was one of amongst 308 people whose ashes, whose remains are there. The capsule containing the ashes will separate from the main Falcon 9 rocket and orbit the Earth for about a year before disintegrating on reentry. So there you go.
That's pretty cool. I kind of feel bad for any of the original Star Trek actors who don't want to be cremated and put into space. Like, what if George Takei is like, I really want to be buried in the ground? You just don't have an option. If you're part of Star Trek, you just have to be in space.
Or people definitely expect that you will be in space.
Yeah, you'll do that. Yeah. I have to admit, I was kind of sad. I had watched the previous launch, which was canceled due to a technical malfunction. Uh-huh. And then I was sad that I missed this launch, and then that just like hit me. I was like, oh my gosh, like I'm living in an era where a company, you know, can just send, send a rocket into space. Yep.
Those days are here now. You know, it's like, I remember when I first saw the movie Alien, it struck me as unusual, because before Alien, we were living in the world of Star Trek and Star Wars, where space was this hallowed ground, you know, where it was never a quotidian experience to be in space. And then Alien kind of changed all that, because these were basically space truckers, you know, who didn't want to be up there, this was just a job for them. And I think we finally reached that era where space is no longer the arena of astronauts, pioneers, trailblazers. It's now sending stuff into space like cargo.
And mining asteroids, you know.
Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah, I think there's still a sense in which it's pretty cool, though. I wonder if, like, honestly, I know, as a geek, I'm sort of, you know, wired to just absolutely love NASA and all the stuff that NASA has done. Mm-hmm. But I think it's an important sense in which I wonder if NASA's era is really kind of over, and you know, they can focus on like sending robots to Mars and sort of the, you know, exploration-y stuff. But you know, really, they shouldn't be, you know, shuttling supplies and doing commercial launches and everything. That's just like, it's time for, you know, industry to come in and really make spaceflight efficient. I mean, that's one problem that NASA has, because they're a big government, you know, they're a big high profile government thing, is that, you know, every congressperson wants to make sure that at least some widget is made in their home county. And, you know, there's no real reason to cut costs, because cutting costs always sounds like you're going to, you know, put things in danger or risk things blowing up because you're skimping. And I think private enterprise is a much better chance of like really sort of taking the torch from them and being like, okay, you've proven that we can go into space. Let's do this for real.
Right. No, totally. And I think that's probably the way for things to go. I think it's a natural evolution of NASA. In fact, now that we're, you know, it's time for commerce to take over, and NASA can focus on the things that commerce cannot yet do in space exploration.
Yeah. And actually get some real value out of it too. I mean, I guess, like, you know, I think when it was a public, when NASA was sort of public expenditure, you know, there was always that question, like, is this really what we should be spending all of our tax dollars on? And I think for a lot of geeks, the answer was, well, obviously space is valuable and cool. But, you know, it's not a crazy question to ask that. And I think, you know, private enterprise is in a much better position to be like, hey, we're making money. People are sending us money to do this. What's your complaint?
Right.
You know, there's far more ridiculous things that people spend far more money on, and they're actually doing something that's both benefiting humanity and themselves.
Yep, And I can't wait till we get to the point where travel in space becomes affordable and cheap.
Oh, my gosh.
You think you'll see it in your lifetime?
Well, I mean, let's not forget, one of SpaceX's very first flights was their, I can't remember the name of it, but it was the first manned, the first private up into space in the rocket car thing that they made. I can't remember the name of it. But, I mean, I think it's already at the point where if you want to, you know, spend a few $100,000 or probably a few million at this point, you know, you can go into space. Now it's just a matter, you know, the more often they're sending things up there, the cheaper those rates are going to go.
Yeah.
I know Virgin has opened or is working on a spaceport in New Mexico for Virgin Galactic.
Oh, man. So excited about that. All right, let's take a little break here. But before we take that break, I want to talk about our sponsor, which is Audible.com. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the audiobook that I want to talk about this week is called I Suck at Girls by Justin Halpern. And if you're familiar with Justin Halpern, he was the guy that started the Twitter account about shit his dad says called, appropriately enough, Shit My Dad Says, and which he spun into a book and a TV series, which wasn't so good. But the Twitter account was good, and this is his latest book, which continues the advice that he gets from his dad. And I think, I don't know, even if his dad is a completely made up character, it's a really original voice. So I'm glad that he's been able to parlay that success into another book. Mm-hmm. It's full of his dad's patented brand of wisdom, also full of new characters just as funny, from his brother, who provides insights into wedding night rituals, to his first boss, who warns Justin to man up. That's what a man does. He takes his shots, and then he scrubs the shit out of some dishes. So the result is A Pilgrim's Progress Through the Landscape of Sex and Love by one of the funniest writers at work today. And that book, along with a 30-day trial to try out Audible's 100,000-plus titles, can be yours by going to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for your free audiobook and the 30-day trial. So we're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the hottest story of the week, Facebook going public. There's not much more I could say about that. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down live on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and social media and how it affects us. I'm here with Christopher Bernard, and the two of us are flying solo. But let's talk about the biggest story of the week, which is that Facebook has gone public. And since Facebook has gone public, it's been like a whirlwind ride, starting with... Facebook opened up at 11%. Their shares opened up at 11% and closed at $38.23 after a nail-biting last half hour of trading when the shares dipped to their $38 IPO price. Most investors had predicted a first-day pop, but they actually, you know, they closed like just about even. More than 576 million shares changed hands. setting a trading volume record for U.S. market debuts. The company had priced their IPO at the top end of the target range and increased the size of the offering, becoming the first U.S. company to go public with a valuation greater than $100 billion. Mark Zuckerberg, his personal net worth is now about $20 billion. He rang the opening bell at on the Friday morning that they opened. Shares fell 11% on Monday as underwriters deserted the stock, and questions continued to be asked about how NASDAQ handled the flotation. It's funny because Business Insider had an interesting story about that. They said the analysts at Facebook's IPO underwriters had cut their estimates for the company in the middle of their IPO roadshow, which was a highly unusual event, and we didn't know why. And now we know because a Facebook executive who knew the business was weak told the analysts to cut their estimate.
Seems like a really bizarre sort of – I mean, obviously there's no way that this wasn't going to be drama. I mean, if the flip side had happened and it shot up by a ton – then, you know, we'd be talking about overvaluations and bubbles and whatever. I mean, there's just simply no way that this was going to be a normal launch.
Right.
And it looks like it wasn't. So I guess we're good there. So a few things I've gleaned about these facts over the last week.
Yeah.
So there was something called, I believe, the green shoe option, which is a goes back to the Green Shoe Company from like the early 1900s, which basically is this stipulation in the contract between the underwriters and the company that if the share the price goes below the opening price on the first day, then the underwriters set aside some amount of money basically to buy up stocks to raise the price to the IPO price. So, and it looks like they exercised that option on the first day. It's why it ended so close to the share price, is they basically bought enough shares to keep it from dipping too low. It also looks like – yeah, I don't know. There was some – I heard some stuff about technical glitches and whatever in there. I don't really understand that.
Yeah, apparently trading was delayed by more than 30 minutes due to technical glitches. And people are actually upset, and there's an investigation at NASDAQ going on into why that technical glitch happened, because NASDAQ, the people at NASDAQ were terribly embarrassed by that.
Yeah, I know if you're a stock exchange, like, you got to be able to handle the volume if you're going to have something go into it and everything. It's a little bit weird that they changed the, you know, the estimates, you know, so abruptly during the roadshow. I don't really know enough, you know, about why that is the case, but I mean, you know, we had been hearing in the weeks going up to it that, you know, they've seen a rather dramatic shift to mobile. And mobile just simply doesn't monetize the way their other ads do. And then there was the really bad news about GM leaving just in like the days beforehand, and they had a particularly big account.
I think something like this calls into question, especially with the Business Insider's report that analysts had privately told the major investors that the stock wasn't going to. That the business was weak, that it calls into the greater question is, you know, does Facebook have a solid business model as a foundation to begin with, or you know, are a lot of the opening investors on Facebook's opening investors, have they basically been duped into buying what will.
I mean, so if I was an investor who was interested in Facebook, and I specifically avoided Facebook because I just don't want to go near anything that volatile at this point, you know, I'm no analyst or whatever. But I, you know, I've been reading through Peter Thiel's lectures on startup classes, and he has a really good one from a few weeks ago on how companies are evaluated and how they sort of realize that value over their lifetime. And I think if you're buying Facebook shares now,
You should be doing so because you think that their long-term growth potential is solid, not because of what you think they're going to be doing next quarter or the quarter after that or even next year. I think that aspect of it is still what one needs to bet on. I mean, they've proven that they can get a pretty significant cash flow. I mean, they're doing revenues of on the order of magnitude of a billion or something. I mean, they're not – this isn't just like random, you know, like, oh, I think they're big because they have so many users. I mean, they really are pulling out a mind-blowing amount of money even for a tech company. I mean, obviously it's not huge, and it seems to be a little bit – you know, big in terms of their valuation relative to their income, but it's certainly a lot of money that they're pulling in. And they've proven that they have been able to, you know, be surprisingly agile for such a giant company with as many users as they have. I mean, they move extremely quickly in terms of rolling out new features mm-hmm. and changing, you know, even the core way that people interact with the site. So I mean, certainly the switch to mobile is going to be a rough one, but they've also shown that they are taking, you know, significant steps to make that transition. And honestly, I think they're doing better than, you know, certain other billion-dollar companies that are in Mountain View, well, they're Menlo Park. But you know, I mean. They have a long ways to go. I don't know. I think Facebook mobile app is probably one of the weakest apps that I use on a day-to-day basis. It's just extremely poor. So I have to believe that they have a significant overhaul in the making with hopefully a rather substantial new way of monetizing mobile users. I mean, that's something that's going to happen, right? I mean, people use their phones all the time. Like, yes, right now ads don't pay as well on mobile, but seriously – like they are, you know, people look at them, and where people look is where advertisers are going to pay to have their ads.
Right.
Just, you know, it's sort of the fundamental law of advertising is eyeballs, you know, eventually equal, you know, conversions, or at least the beginnings of those conversions. So if they can figure out how to turn that into, you know, a good cash flow stream, then they'll be pretty good. But you're right. I mean, they're certainly not doing well in terms of like short-term gains, and definitely don't look like they're going to be, you know, turning around the market anytime soon. But
somebody mentioned that Google's got something coming up, and they may be announcing something at Google, making another announcement social wise, and that it might be a good idea to. Wait, if you're thinking about investing in Facebook, waiting until after Google's announcement to see if Facebook's stock will drop, and then you can actually pick it up at a little bit of a discount.
So. That might be a smart idea. I haven't heard anything about a Google social thing. I mean, I guess they could be doing something with YouTube, which honestly is kind of amazing. Sorry. How little that's been integrated into Plus. I mean, it certainly has had, you know, some integration, but they seem to be keeping it as a very separate entity, which is odd since YouTube is arguably their most successful social site.
As if all of this poor stock performance or disappointing stock performance wasn't enough, 21 privacy lawsuits have combined into a single class action lawsuit against Facebook this last week. Charging Facebook with violating user privacy by allegedly tracking their web usage. Stewart's Law is asking for $15 billion, a sum it arrived by calling on the U.S. Wiretap Act, which provides statutory damages of greater than $100 per violation per day. This is just another... you know, another blow to Facebook. Facebook's no stranger to these lawsuits. They get hit by these all the time.
You know, the more I've been I mean, I don't know anything about the merits of this particular case, uh-huh. but, you know, the more I've watched the tech industry, the more I don't really get concerned when I see the initial headline for a lawsuit, because, I mean, it's the nature of the justice system that, like, you can bring a lawsuit against anybody at any time for anything. Like, I mean, I could sue Andy for, you know, I don't know, failure to be failure to let me get as awesome of a karma on Dig as he had on Dig. You know, like, whatever. Like, it'd probably get thrown out, but I can file for it, you sure. know, and get some headlines. And you know, obviously, you know, it's in their interest to always go for as high of a valuation as they yeah. possibly can in the lawsuit. And Facebook, you know, will be able to, you know, fire back. And Facebook has an awful lot of money to throw at this at the moment and an awful lot of vested interest in ensuring that this, you know, goes their way. So, I mean, I guess it was sort of inevitable that there was going to be lawsuits and stuff happening. Now that people can actually put a number on how much Facebook is worth, it's, you know, definitely time to bring out lawyers. I guess I think one thing that I haven't seen as much of mm-hmm. stated, but I'm personally excited for this. Facebook's going public brings a huge amount of liquidity back into the investment market. There are a yeah. lot of millionaires around now who weren't yeah. well, who weren't able to use their millions earlier, last week, and that's gonna be really good for, you know, the tech industry in particular, as, you know, many of those people are going to become angels. A lot of that money is going to go back to, you know, the companies, the VC firms that invested in Facebook. They're going to be able to invest in more startups. You know, it's a little bit of a problem when you have one company that has a huge amount of funding that it's being raised that isn't public, because although, you know, that means that the VC firms in question and everything have you know, gotten their return on it, it's still illiquid. They can't sell it easily.
Right.
And so we have a sort of, it's like a dam has been on, you know, burst forth in the market for equity and investing. So I think we can see some continued investing in the Valley, which is, I think, generally a good thing, because it's basically the one bright spot in the economy yeah. these days.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it that way, but you're absolutely right. A lot of these people are going to be cash liquid now and will want to spend that on further ventures, which drives the whole industry.
Yeah, exactly. Are you familiar with AngelList?
No.
Okay, yeah. So that website has really been sort of revolutionizing the way that raising money has done around it. AngelList is essentially a social network for founders and angel investors. You basically go on there, you put your company, and you say who your investors are, and you say what companies you founded and who your early employees are. And it basically allows, you know, angels to look for promising startups and startups to sort of build up relationships with potential investors in order to get that going. And the sort of pre-Series A round, which mm-hmm. is, you know, arguably one of the most important times of a company, like getting to the point where they can convince anyone, you know, to do something, or, you know, if they need some upfront money to even get a version 1.0 out the door. So, you know, that democratization of angel investing is really going to be awesome in connection with Facebook to bring a lot more of angel money to the Valley.
Looks and, like their site is down currently.
AngelList?
Yeah.
Angel.co is the website.
Yeah.
Sorry, I should have.
And the conference I was referring to before with Google is the Google I/O conference, and I don't know when that's coming up.
Yeah, isn't Facebook Connect coming out too? I think it's all in June. There's like Apple's WWDC, Google I/O, Facebook Connect, yeah. Twitter's thing. I don't even remember what it's called. It's always in the spring. There's like four of them. The big
right. Google I/O is June 27th through the 29th.
Okay. I don't know if Twitter's doing. I haven't heard anything about Twitter's conference this year.
Let's wrap up this main talk and get into our, since our time with you is limited.
Oh yeah.
So as a last little note, as if Mark Zuckerberg wasn't busy enough readying his company to go public this last week, he also somehow found time to marry longtime sweetheart Priscilla Chan last Saturday. They got married at his home in Palo Alto, California. The couple was surrounded by 100 guests who thought they were there to attend a party for Chan's graduation from University of California Medical School. Instead of a hoodie, Zuckerberg dressed in a slick suit and tie, and Chan wore a white wedding dress.
Oh, good sort of weekend for them, you know? Like, yeah. Let's face it. Like, this has got to be a rough weekend for Zuckerberg. Like, just, you know, like, you know, he's certainly up for it, but it's still a lot of work.
Yep. I can't imagine. The only thing I can imagine is the relief of this week, of the week after, you know, yeah. the IPO launching and the wedding, to finally be able to take a break and go, whew, you know, all right, yeah. on to the next thing.
I really hope that he's like up in Napa somewhere, you know, just yeah. totally getting away from it, because, you know, I don't know. He needs it.
All right, let's take another little break here. We're going to take a break, listen to some music, and when we come back, we're going to have a few little stories about Google. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down live on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cercini. I'm here with Christopher Bernor. It's just the two of us today. We don't have
holding down the fort.
Yes, holding down the fort, as it were. But I think we're doing fine.
Yeah, I think so too. Pretty good.
So let's talk about some Google stuff. Google officially closed the deal on their acquisition of Motorola Mobility. Mm-hmm. When they first approached Motorola, it was mostly Google was mostly interested in getting Motorola's trove of 17,000 plus patents to help defend the Android operating system against lawsuits by Oracle, Microsoft, Apple, and others. Now it's going to have to figure out the cutthroat, low-margin world of hardware. That means production lines, supply chains, and 1-800 customer help numbers. So it's, I mean, this has been in the works for a while, but now it's officially official, and we're going to be seeing some hardware out of Google, out of Motorola and Google, and yeah. And probably more. You know, it's been speculated that we're going to see more preference with Android support toward Motorola devices now.
Yeah, either that or I think what they're realizing with this is that having the sort of like flagship phone yeah. that they have said just really isn't working. Like, you know, there's just a huge quality sort of disjoint in Android phones, you know, between the flagship ones, the ones that the rest right. of us buy. And I think they're realizing, you know, they really need like some mass market, like very definitive sort of like ways of saying this is the definitive version of Android. I think actually producing their own stuff is just the way to go. And they honestly really need, I think you're right when you talked about like the support and the 800 numbers. I mean, if you think that Google's social genes are bad, right. their end user support is non-existent.
Right.
I mean, quick, call Google's helpline.
Yeah, exactly.
I give up, you know? Like,
you know, what's interesting about this, though, is that you know, now that they have like this complete beginning to end chain of manufacturing, much like Apple does, they can now like focus their full weight of that experience and that technology in one supply line. And I'm really fascinated to see now what they are going to do to stand up to. Basically, Apple is the big competitor here, and then of course Microsoft, Nokia. So I'm yeah. really curious about what Google is going to bring to the plate now that it can none of it controls the full production line.
Yeah, well, and you know, how long is it going to be before they get hit with another monopolies lawsuit
right.
in this? I mean, they're I don't know. I mean, I know that it got proved and everything, so they'll probably be a little bit. But it's a little bit. I'd be a little bit wary of them. They have to tread carefully because they're under an awful lot of observation, given just how much they own of that now.
Let's jump to that. We actually have a story about that, but it's like the last one. But I'm going to jump to that since we brought it up. Google has a matter of weeks to allay concerns that it's abusing its dominant position in the search engine market, according to the European Commission. An investigation by Europe's antitrust had looked at whether Google gave preferential treatment to its own services in its search results. The investigation outlined four areas where Google's practices may be considered as abuses of dominance, and they are the manner in which Google displays its own vertical search services differently from other competing products. And we've heard that same claim before domestically. I can't remember, but there was a claim, I think it was maybe some investigative reporters who were claiming that searches on Google search tended to come up with their own products more than other products. Another point is how Google copies content, quote, copies content from other websites such as restaurant reviews to include within their own services. And that hasn't gotten any better with Google's new service that puts like additional information in the sidebar that we discussed on last week's show. The exclusivity Google has to sell advertising around search terms people use, and restrictions surrounding portability of advertising content, which prevents seamless transfer to other non-Google platforms.
There's an awful lot of control that they have over what people see. And I mean, you know, I think this is, you know, their attempts to, you know, turn themselves into a social network is really only exacerbate that. I mean, let's face it, if they make it so that everything in their site is a single, you know, product, then it's going to be a lot harder to say, you know, oh, well, you know, it's just showing up at the top because it's the best, you know. Yeah. No, I agree.
As far as like the claim that it's tough because they are the dominant search in the engine in the industry, and when you make a claim like they have the exclusivity to sell advertising around search terms people use, but any browser has that exclusivity for themselves. We're just talking about Google. It seems exclusive because Google is the largest. Is the search term, the search engine people use the most. So I don't know. But I think this is one of those cases like Microsoft and even Apple in some cases where if you get big enough and you are global enough, people are going to consider you a monopoly in some way or another. You know, Google has no real competition in search other than like Bing, and that's a, I don't think that's a close second.
Yeah. DuckDuckGo.
DuckDuckGo, yes.
So you apparently DuckDuckGo made a few hundred thousand in revenue last year.
Oh, did they?
Which is pretty awesome for them. I mean, especially given that last year they were tiny.
Uh-huh.
They have really skyrocketed in the, if you look at their like usage graphs, they're in the hockey stick growth phase right now.
Oh, nice.
They've been doubling every few months the last 6 months or so. So good for them. But they got a long ways to go before they're even remotely close.
And they make their revenue off of ad sales as well?
Yep. Display advertising, just like Google does.
Speaking of the hockey stick, Google Chrome has long been expected to leapfrog Microsoft's Internet Explorer to take the position as the web's most used browser. And according to data from StatCounter, the momentous change of leadership happened last week. StatCounter figures show that Chrome's line of usage creeped to overtake IE's for the first week ever, with Firefox, Safari, and Opera completing the top five respectively.
Yeah, I saw that. That's pretty big news. You know, IE has dominated for just so long. I did hear that those numbers are a little bit suspect because of the way that StatCounter counts them combined with the way that Chrome runs itself. There's some reason to believe. So Chrome preloads a lot of stuff in the background, especially when you're doing searches. It'll like preload pages that it thinks you're going to is things you're going to click on. And stat counter counts every one of those pages, even if the user never clicks on it. So, you know, it's possible that might be skewed a little bit. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I mean, it's not like, you know, stat counter has been doing this for a while. So if they're wrong, they're at least wrong consistently, which means, you know, it won't be a matter. It would probably only be a matter of time before the other browsers sort of come up. So I really kind of feel bad for Firefox, honestly, these days. Like, Firefox is still doing some amazing stuff, but I feel like the sort of wind has sort of really fallen out of their sails. And, you know, they feel much more like truly open source to me.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I use Chromium instead of Chrome, but I can't for the life of me tell what the difference is other than the logo's blue instead of red, green, and gold.
Well, I have to tell you, Firefox is still my go-to browser. The only reason I usually go to Chrome is when I want to try out something that is like HTML5, and sometimes some of the HTML5 apps just don't work on Firefox, but they consistently do on Chrome.
Yeah, no, Chrome really has, it seems like, some of the best JavaScript and sort of API support. I mean, since Firefox switched to their like 6-week release period, I think they've gotten way better in terms of that. They're really sort of moving pretty quickly. But yeah, I think the other thing that Chrome really needs to work on is their memory footprint. I don't know about you, but I feel like Chrome has just exploded in terms of how much memory it's using. Now, it might be web pages. It might be that web pages, you know, all these JavaScript, CSS3 heavy pages, those take an awful lot of horsepower to run. Gone are the days where, oh, it's just a web page, I don't need that much processing power. Like, web pages are now essentially desktop applications running in a browser. Really? And as fast and awesome as JavaScript has become, it's still not native, and tends to have a lot more overhead than your typical, you know, desktop application has become.
Especially when you're recreating Moog synthesizers on your
exactly. Yeah. No,
I remember that the whole memory usage thing was a complaint about Firefox not that long ago, maybe a couple of years ago.
So yeah, it's ironic. That was actually the reason why I left Firefox. I'm a hog when it comes to tabs, and just open tons and tons and tons and tons of them. And
so is it endemic? Is it just an artifact of web pages in general, or is it something that no web browser can avoid the curse of being a memory hog eventually?
You know, I don't know, because, you know, especially when I've had Chrome open for a while, I see some really weird things. Like, I might have one site, you know, like I'll leave like a ebook or something that I'm reading open in one tab, and it's going to be like literally just text, no HTML or no JavaScript, nothing fancy, just like a text web page. You know, I open it up and I look on the tab and it's taking like 80 megs of, you know, memory. And then if I leave it open for a week, I go back there, and now it's taking up like 200 megabytes of RAM for the same process that I haven't done anything on. I really feel like there are some leaks that they're really going to have to nail down, because it does seem like the longer a tab is open, the more space it ends up taking up. And that's indicative of some problems, because unless you're using it, or unless it's actually generating data, it really should be collecting any additional memory that it allocates when it's done with it.
Yeah.
So, anyway, good for them. It's good to see that modern browsers are finally beginning to take over.
Yeah, yeah. The second generation, or second or third generation, really.
Browsers. Yeah.
Firefox is really like the second generation.
Yeah.
So after Netscape and all that, remember those days?
Yeah, I do remember Netscape. Back when you had to pay for a browser, the heck was with that.
Well, Christopher Bernard, I would love to continue talking with you more and more, but unfortunately, I think you've got to run pretty soon.
Yeah, I've got my keys in my hand. I'm ready to step out the door. So,
let me ask you before you leave, where can we find you online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
So you can find me on my blog at chrisbernard.com. CHRISBURNOR. And I've been trying to do pretty well about actually writing up some article at least once a week on, you know, startups or some of the more technical things. But I've have a really interesting view of the startup world now. And then speaking of that, I also co-curate the Startup Digest reading list on Fridays. It's our list of the best startup-related articles on the web. And you can find me on Twitter at CRISBURNOR, CHRISBURNOR. And I have to thank the listeners. Since I've gone on this podcast, my follower count is... slowly started coming
up. Keep following him.
I'm not the social media maven that the rest of the guys on here on. I'm the nerd programmer who sits in the background. So having a few hundred followers really warms my heart. So
as for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com or gplus.to/MrBabyMan, facebook.com/MrBabyMan, anywhere where your good Mr. Babymans could be found and searched out. You can check out past episodes of The Drill Down as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and those links are in the upper right-hand column of the page. facebook.com/thedrilldown, twitter.com/thedrilldown. Sign up at j.mp/subus to get SMS alerts when The Drill Down goes live. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish. And let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is the wonderful audience that is listening to us now by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that is it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.